Jim, what's your suggestion for dealing with labor unions that hold a large degree of power in a negotiation?
Well, I've coached labor negotiations on both sides, and I've got to tell you, there's no such thing as power in a negotiation. That's a myth. That is a self-induced emotional state. When you think someone else has the power, you're putting yourself in a fearful position, and it clouds your vision, and it has a negative effect on the decision-making. I've been on the side of management where management had, according to the newspapers and according to a lot of people, were over a barrel, quote, quote, by labor, and we got pay concessions, and we created vision about the importance of those pay concessions and the job security of the union members. On the other side of the coin, I was on the labor side where we created vision of value and the importance of standard of living for the families and the health care of the families and the performance of their duties that were very valuable. So it all boils down to the creation of vision and how we're seen. But there is no such thing as power. All that does is heighten the emotions and create fear.
Jim, I'm a chiropractic physician with 12 years experience. I give recommendations to patients based on what they need and not what they can afford. For example, pain relief for a few visits or corrections over several months. What is the best way to give options that don't overwhelm the patient but still allow them choices that give them help? In a written sheet with recommended services listed line by line item, or just a case fee given verbally across the desk?
Well, I think there's a combination here. The key in that whole arena, that combination has to create vision so that the patient has a clear vision of how that pain relief can be administered and what that will do for them. They have to be able to see that walking freely without that back pain. It's all going to be out there where they can see it. And if you can paint the vision of what that pain is now doing to them, and when that pain is taken away, what it can do for them, you'll be providing a great service. And I believe truly that's a combination of verbal and a combination written. I would not be surprised if your state rules and laws don't require written anyway.
Hi, Jim. I have a question about recruiting new salespeople for insurance. Also, it could apply to network marketing. You talk about in your book about not being needy and being in the other person's world. How would you frame a recruiting process to not be needy in your interviews?
I would get into their world immediately and find out what brought them here. What were your thoughts when you decided to come here? Where are you trying to go? That whole arena is a very easy arena to develop to get into their world because they're there for a reason. It's a matter of just simply having the tools to be able to ask the questions to get there fairly quickly.
Jim, I'm a commodity manager. I'm on the buy side for a Fortune 100 company, but often have very little leverage with suppliers due to our division's low volumes, uncommon suppliers from the rest of the company, and high volatility in the electronics market. My question is, what is the best way to negotiate when you have very little leverage and the other side knows it? I've queried numerous negotiating experts and rarely have gotten a satisfactory or helpful answer. I hope you can help. Best regards, Ryan Campbell.
Well, Ryan, on the buy side, it's simply negotiation. The challenge you have, Ryan, is somehow, some way, you believe that there is such a thing as leverage in negotiation, and there isn't. There is no such thing as leverage. There is no such thing as power. There's only vision and opportunity and decision. And so you have to have the tools to be able to create vision for the suppliers of what the opportunities are for them within your organization. As far as commodities go, I want to address that word also. For your sake, you have to realize that you are not a commodity manager. You can be a buyer, you can be a purchasing agent, but commodities, you do not deal in corn, you do not deal in wheat, you do not deal in petroleum, hog bellies. Those are commodities. What you're dealing with in the electronics world has features and benefits, some better than worse than others. So that would also help you to get rid of that mindset of commodity. But you must learn how to create vision of opportunity for your suppliers. And when you do that, you'll find they'll give you discounts you didn't ask for.
Jim, I come from a nursing background and always struggle to communicate effectively with patients when they don't want to take their medications, among other things. The thought of someone being hurt or dying because of my inability scares me. How do I remove the fear? How could I negotiate a quality result?
Your ability to create vision of consequence, your ability to negotiate agendas, your ability to bring about agreements are critical tools that you've got to have in place. You're in a life and death situation, so those are tools you've got to develop.
As a person who is working in the music industry, I often feel that I'm not getting a fair shake in negotiating music deals. I feel like people make you feel bad or lucky to have a chance. I cave under the pressure because I know getting paid is not guaranteed. How do I continue pursuing the finer points that make a difference to me financially while putting their concerns to bed, ultimately coming out on top?
What's happening to you is, again, you have a win-win compromise mindset. You're completely in a fearful mode. Therefore, you really have no system to really deal with the tactics that they're throwing at you. And those tactics are always easily defeated by principle, and they're always defeated by rules and laws. But unfortunately, you don't have those organized in a system. So until you get a system to do that, you're trapped in that arena.
Lately, I've been helping small business owners sell their businesses to third parties. How would you deal with small business owners that already think they are expert negotiators? Seems that entrepreneur types are so used to going it alone that many have trouble taking advice when negotiating, even to the extent of screwing up a deal.
Let's face the real problem here. In order to break through with people like that, they have to discover, oh my goodness, this person knows something I didn't even know. So you're going to have to get that before you can expect change.
I negotiate with personal injury lawyers for a living. Most of the time, it is an adversarial relationship, and many times I am well aware that my position is not as strong as the attorney I'm negotiating with. What is the best way to negotiate when you know you have a weaker position than your adversary?
If you're negotiating with personal injury attorneys, then I'm going to take a guess that you're working with an insurance company, and how you could have a weaker position dealing with injury attorneys when you have the money is beyond me. That's all an emotional arena mindset that you're carrying around. And honestly, it sounds to me like you're playing that world of give and take. And the question I have is, how do you help the attorney discover, how do you help them see that the solution you're offering is timely and effective, and that, you know, to go down any other path is a very reckless thing to do for their client. So you're stuck in that collective bargaining, win-win, pie is bigger mindset. So you've got to get out of that and get into a decision mindset.
How do I negotiate with my son without sounding like a dictator?
That is a great question. And I think that if I could ever get this across, it would be very, very helpful. I think it's very important that you influence your son so he has a vision of the value of what you're trying to deliver to him. I tell a story all the time about one of my sons. I remember it was a fun story. He came home from third grade and said, "Dad, I'm not going to school tomorrow." Now, this is a youngster that was an A student and a wonderful student. And I was fearful that maybe he was being picked on. Now, he's a pretty tough kid. But I was fearful that something was going on in school. And I said, "Why wouldn't you want to go to school?" He said, "Well, you know, Jimbo's home from college." This was in May. "Jimbo's home from college, Dad, and we don't get to see him. And I don't want to go to school tomorrow. I think I'd rather go to work with Jimbo." And I said, "Okay, that's great. Why don't we pack a lunch and have you go to work with Jimbo in the morning? He's working in carpentry work here on the ranch, and so you can pass up lumber to him, and you can work with him all day, and it's only going to be 95 degrees here, and you're going to have a great time."
And Jimbo's his brother.
Jimbo's a big brother, and this is a third grader. Jimbo's a college football player, and a little brother wants to be one. And so Brian gets this vision, this is going to be really great, right? And Mom packs a lunch, and off he goes with Jimbo. And we let him miss school that day. And, you know, he went down, and at about 12 o'clock, he came dragging up the driveway and said, "I think I'm going to go to school tomorrow."
That's funny.
He discovered it'd be more fun to be with Jimbo after Jimbo gets off work, jumping in the swimming pool, than being at the workplace all day. school was a pretty cool place to be. So that was a discovery process. But the ability to help these kids discover where they can go and where they can be and what they can do. I know my oldest son, Jim, I was a pilot in another life. And in fact, when Jim was a youngster, he used to see me fly the jets around the pattern at an Air Force base I flew at because our house was close enough to where the fighters flew around the pattern, and I'd fly over the house and I'd give him a call and tell him what time I was flying, and between such and such time I'll be in the pattern, I'll rock my wings, and Jimmy and all these little buddies would see me rock my wings. Deep in my heart, I wanted him to be a pilot, but that's like every dad does. But I also knew that it was a dangerous arena, so he had to want to be there. So I just never really played it up and never talked to him about it. And then one day in college, he called and said, "Dad, I just went to a U2 concert, and a flight of four fighters just came through the stadium, and I realized I want to be like you. I want to be a fighter pilot." But that was in college. And so you always hope they have that discovery. But that discovery, that vision is going to be the driving force. So when you're dealing with your children, if you can create that vision, it's very powerful.
Yeah, those are great stories. Thanks for sharing. Jim, I'm bidding on a big contract for the first time and found myself facing a seasoned negotiator complete with their legal team on their turf. It was supposed to be a technical clarification, and I was not aware that it would lead to nitpicking about the contract specifications. How do I go about skirting the issue they raise when I am not fully conversant with the legal aspects of the contract? I don't have my legal aid with me.
You're living under an agenda you should not accept. You know, agendas are required to be negotiated. And if you went to a meeting and they changed the game on you, it's perfectly within the bounds of, you know, human dignity and human responsibility that you not engage without your legal counsel dealing with lawyers. You don't go into a legal meeting without a lawyer, for goodness sake. So the problem is you didn't negotiate the agenda, or they tried to change the agenda on you. There's not a thing wrong with thanking them very much, but you weren't prepared for a legal meeting, so you were prepared for a visual high-altitude meeting to look at the challenges the contract solved, but the nitty-gritty of the contract, you're not prepared to look at or to bid on. So that's a perfect example of saying no and rescheduling.
Jim, here's the quick background. I'm looking to bring a group of doctors into an investment. Most of them have little or no business experience. Some of them have been watching shows like Shark Tank and think that because they bring money to the table, they should be able to make onerous demands. They miss the point that the people on that show bring money, know-how, contacts, and a team to the table. How would you suggest negotiating with people who have the money you need but are not knowledgeable enough to properly negotiate with you and need you to educate them in the negotiating process?
That all boils down again to having a system in place that removes all those barriers prior to moving forward. A lot of that is agenda, and the reality here is the problems you've outlined have got to be negotiated out first. I mean, the fact that someone brings money to the table, but they don't bring expertise, they don't bring contacts, they don't bring a team capable of marketing and selling and developing and engineering, all of those things. But, you know, also, shame on you for just going for the money. You know, you really have to have a mission and purpose in place when you're going out for funding. What's the real mission? What's the real purpose of where you're going? What are you delivering to the investor? What are you expecting the investor to deliver to you? If it's just money, be quiet and sit in the corner. They need to be aware of that, and that has to be negotiated. So I'd strongly recommend that you have that figured out and in place before you move forward with anybody with just money. They should clearly be aware that that's all they're going to be able to do is sit there and watch.
Hi, Jim. I'm interested in knowing how you would handle a situation where more than one company is competing for a contract and you want to outbid the competition but not give away the farm. How would you attempt to find out what would close the deal and lock out the competitors?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't. I'm not concerned about the competitors. Competitors, and we do hundreds of contracts every year or so worth $4 or $5 billion, and we never worry about the competition. As far as bidding goes, we don't. We always anticipate full price because we can create the vision of what we're delivering and what's coming down the road and the whole encompassing package. What we're doing, and all of my clients that have a special benefit and differentiation from quote-unquote competitors. So we don't participate in negotiations the way you're discussing.
Jim, after reading and listening to your awesome material, when I start talking or negotiating with some I don't really trust, what should I say when he starts with, will this be a win-win deal, especially when I know he's not really thinking that?
You know, I'm not big on tactics, and I'll say this, and you say that, and then you say this, and they'll say that. But I love it when someone says to one of my clients who we're coaching, who has a checklist and is armed and prepared, I love it when they say this will be a win-win deal. And we say, well, that'll be up to you, because we don't play win-win. You know, we move the mission and purpose forward, and we try to provide a mission and purpose in their world that delivers everything they're looking for, and our price is our price. So this whole thing of these tactics and what do you say and et cetera, I would probably coach my team to not pay much attention to any of those comments.
Hi, Jim. I bought Start With No in 2003. I listened to your send-off interview over and over and over. Both great. Question. I've used your method successfully. Some clients want a contract. Others don't. Most of the time, this works out. There's a thin line between trust and agreements. When should I insist on a contract? At times, I've trusted too much and lost out on the deal.
If it's a pattern of losing out on the deal because you don't have a contract, then you probably should have a contract. But it always boils down to, will you defend the contract? Will you spend the resources it's going to take to defend the contract? Contracts have two or three purposes. One, of course, is to get paid. It's also to lock in commitment. It's also an outline of exactly what's being delivered on one hand. But on the other hand, I would just ask you, if you had a contract and if they broke it, would you use your resources to defend it? That's always the litmus test.
Jim, I'm curious if your negotiation training is only for one-on-one sales situations, or can it be used in selling one-to-many, like, for instance, at a seminar or a webinar?
Absolutely. I've spent my whole life selling to many. So, yes, to answer your questions, it's absolutely required to sell to many.
Jim, I've enjoyed learning about your negotiating style. However, it seems to take place at a high corporate level. Can your negotiating techniques work for just selling consulting services? How could a consultant employ your methods to gain a client?
If you really think about what you've asked, you'll find that I started in 1987 talking to individual people in individual jobs. And right now, today, we're coaching a tombstone salesman in Alabama, an individual person. We're also coaching individual consultants as well as large consulting firms. So that's exactly what we do. I can't imagine how you could be very successful as a consultant if you didn't have these tools and didn't have ownership of the tools.
What advice would you give people looking for jobs regarding negotiation in this soft market? The temptation for some of us to think, grab whatever they offer or they'll choose someone else.
It's interesting to me how many people don't take stock of what they bring to the game. And they don't have confidence in what they bring to the game. And the emotions are running wild when the more you need, notice that word need, the more you need, the more the heightened emotions and the more fear of failure sets in the emotional arena where decisions are made. And it's not even recognized by the masses that people make their decisions emotionally 100% of the time. And vision drives those emotions and decision. You heard a term in the mind's eye of the brain, and that's the emotional side of the brain where decisions are made. So your ability to create vision of what you bring to the arena is critical to the opportunity to negotiate and discuss your value or your future value. For example, I just helped coach a negotiation for a job, actually a career move, and it was very interesting because the vision was created of past performance and future performance, and the vision was created of this ownership of this system of negotiation that brought about in the current accomplishments in the current job that would move them into this other organization. They were actually working while they were going through the interview process. They're being recruited. And the other party doing the recruiting actually had a vision that this was a person they needed to bring on board. So they actually made an offer that almost doubled the income of this person to get them out of where they were into this new opportunity. That was 9 months ago, and that person's been promoted twice since, simply because they had a system and they helped the other party see the system and how it worked and how they were able to perform the way they were. So it's how you create the vision.
When dealing with supermarket chains in our particular area, we find that they have a long-term supply agreement with our competitor who they've been dealing with for a number of years and are unwilling to purchase from alternative suppliers. Their current supplier has a good relationship, produces a product at a very low cost to them. However, as the supermarket profit is based on percent and the product is basic with a low sell price, I believe they are missing out on potential profits. I've run this argument but not had a positive response so far. Do you have any suggestions on how to develop a better approach on this point or where else I can look for motivation to have them switch suppliers other than price?
There's a lot of reasons people believe that price is the driving force in a negotiation, and it's not. It never is. It's the vision. So the fact that you're pushing more profit, that falls on deaf ears. It's just proof that I've learned this over and over again, that price is never the driving force in a negotiation. And you're a living example of it for asking the question. My question to you is, what would those profits deliver to the supermarket chain? And what would they accomplish with those profits? And what could they do with them? So there's no vision around the profit, just the fact that it's profit. The assumption's made that everybody sees what that means. And you'd be surprised to a lot of people who aren't responsible for the profit, they can't see it. So that leads to the next question. Are you really talking with the people who are responsible for the profit and loss of those markets? Without negotiating with the qualified, your words are landing on deaf ears.
When negotiating a consulting or project fee, how do you resolve a consulting client's initial question of how much is it going to cost me when even they do not have all of the required information needed up front and the client needs information for their budgeting purposes and to report up to their boss?
It sounds to me like you have no idea in a consulting agreement what their problems are and what problems you're solving. So without their vision very clear in their mind of what their problems are and then very clear in their mind what you're solving, I don't know how you could discuss price. It's beyond me. Again, it's the old throw the numbers out and let's go back and forth till one of us feel lucky or I give up. That'll be the number. That's called collective bargaining, give and take. And that's a very weak way to negotiate agreements, especially in the consulting world, because what you deliver is the key to the value, the key to the price that you're paid.
I usually have 2 points at which I'm prepared to close the deal. For example, what I would like and what is the absolute minimum I will accept, the lowest point I can still make a small profit. How do I keep closest to my first point, what I would like?
Stop having a fallback position. Your mindset is that you're prepared to give up before you even go in what you would like and then what you'll take. So why don't you just move it up to what you want and that's it, and then work to create vision of what you want being a reasonable value or price or cost to them to solve the problems that they have that you've helped them see very clearly.
I think many will want to know this answer. The best ways for consumers or small businesses to negotiate very low payments for past owing consumer credit debt. For example, if you have $50,000 in debt, if you only want to pay 5% on the dollar, like your GM, what would be the best way to do it? How do you start the conversation, or would you do it by a letter first? Someone suspecting that there's a ton of people in debt, and they're asking you for some kind of way to see if they can negotiate down their credit card debt. Any ideas?
They've got to create the vision of failure to some degree. The heavier the failure degree, then let the holder of the debt decide what they're willing to give up. That's really the bottom line. If they can create a vision of impossible recovery of the debt, you know, what will they settle for and then go from there? That's probably the only way they're going to do it. But without that vision, the person holding the debt, there's no chance they're going to reduce it.